Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview people who are making a positive difference in the world. We explore important aspects and areas of life, including business, sales, spiritual, physical, mental, relationships, disabilities, and other topics. And our broadcast team consists of outstanding people from Canada and the U.S., including several Napoleon Hill certified instructors and authors. My name's Tom Tutall Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor. I'm also a regular contributor to their weekly newsletter. And in March of 2012, I spoke at the Napoleon Hill International Convention in Malaysia, where I shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, who was the keynote speaker at that event. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 44 years now. And in that time, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced. I've also been hospitalized about 40 times. And I stand about 5'1" due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. I'm also a senior editorial researcher at the Canadian Business Journal, which is a digital-only publication. We're the official and only media partner with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. Find out more about me, my website is tom2tall.com, and I am extremely, extremely excited to have as my guest today Kyle Maynard. His story is incredible. I finished his book on the weekend. It had me in all kinds of great emotions. Kyle was born in 1986 with a condition known as congenital amputation. His parents, Scott and Anita, had no idea their firstborn son would be born with a disability, but they made a critical decision early on to drive him to be as independent as possible, beginning what Kyle calls his pursuit of normalcy. And consequently, with basically 2 elbows, he can type up to 50 words per minute on a normal keyboard, eat and write without any adaptations, drive a vehicle that has little modification, and live on his own in a 3-story townhouse in Atlanta, Georgia. His athletic journey, this is incredible, began as an 11-year-old that wanted to wrestle, and a coach that gave him an opportunity to try. After losing every single match his first year and most his second, I think he went 0 for 35, Kyle, with his iron will and parents who wouldn't let him give up on himself, found a way to win 36 varsity matches his senior year, defeating several state place finishers and state champions during his final season. Kyle began weight training at the same age, and after a modest start, he attained the GNC's World's Strongest Teen Championship by bench pressing 23 repetitions of 240 pounds. And he weighs less than half of that. In February 2009, with leather straps and chains attached to his arms, he successfully lifted 420 pounds. So now his accomplishments extend far beyond wrestling or the weight room. He is the 2004 ESPY Award winner, Best Athlete with a Disability, and a year later was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. In 2007, he was elected by the USJCs as one of the top 10 outstanding young Americans. And in 2008, he received the highest recognition award of the Secretary of Health and Human Services for his efforts as a life role model, motivational speaker, and humanitarian. There is a bunch more, but we're going to get into it on this call. Welcome to the show today, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Whoever you're talking about there sounds a lot more interesting than me. I don't know. That's got to be somebody else.
As I was reading your book, I was kind of struck that you seem like a normal guy. And what I tell people when I'm speaking is that if you had told me 25 years ago that I would be talking about my arthritis and my disability to encourage people, A, I would have been pissed off, and B, I would have been laughing at you. And it sounds like from reading your book that that would not have been your definite purpose in life, that this is just something you live with, right?
Yeah, that's not a far-off prediction, too. I mean, I never really figured I would be doing what I'm doing now either. Just kind of fell into it.
Yeah, and sometimes I was really struck by your faith. Many people will hide that when they're in the motivational speaking arena. However, your parents and your grandfather was a real man of faith, and I can't imagine if I were a parent and didn't have any idea this was going to happen, what they went through. They must have questioned God, but in the end, they decided, hey, let's just make him as normal as he can be. You write about that in the book. Tell me a little bit about it and how your parents felt and your grandparents, because after the initial shock, it looks like it was just Kyle, just another baby boy.
Yeah, you know, it was, I'm sure it's even before I have any conscious memory of it, so it's really just me recounting this is, you know, telling the stories that they've told me, but I'm sure that initially there were a lot of doubts and fears, frustrations, them not knowing, you know, what the future was going to go on hold for me, but they, you know, really, I think, made some important decisions to not treat me differently, you know, kind of sounds similar to the path that you had growing up where, you know, really they kind of understood the fact that everybody's got something, everybody's got some disability and really just that I was going to rise to the level of the expectations they set. And, I you know, it's been kind of an important theme throughout my whole life.
I love that, and that's so much true in my case as well. My mother and I saw a lot of arthritis, kids with arthritis in waiting rooms, and their parents were treating them like they were wrapped in a bubble. They wouldn't let them do anything. They didn't go to school. They got homeschooled, and you know, I played hockey. Come on, that's not a great thing for someone with rheumatoid arthritis, but hey, I'm going to play anyway, you know?
Right.
And so that I think that was the greatest advantage I had, was that my parents said, okay, let's not treat him like, you know, he's got, he can't do anything. Let's let him do whatever he wants to do. And the agreement always was, tomorrow you're going to be so sore you won't be able to get out of bed. And I'll be like, that's fine, I want to play hockey today. It sounds like
you
were the same.
I think, though, if you look at, like, a lot of kids, you know, kids are naturally fearless, you know, growing up, and it's us adults that go and place the fears on kids. Kids aren't born with the fears. And, you know, and I think when you are a child with a disability, then it's even expounded to the point where now you have that many more people, including your parents, that are trying to protect you from being hurt. And they're not doing it maliciously. They aren't doing it to try to, you know, create someone who has problems later on in life or whatever else. But, you know, they're doing it, it's born really out of a sense of love and protection and nurturing. It's just we don't realize that the longer-term love is to, you know, let go of some of that stuff and to not be there to coddle all the time.
Exactly, and by coddling all the time, you probably create a weaker person more so than a stronger person. And I love your story about wrestling. Like, I'm not a fan of wrestling, but I was reading your book like, okay, well, he's going to win this one. And what an amazing story. And in the book, you talked about how your mom, you know, moms can be a little more practical. They don't want you to be disappointed, but your dad was like, yeah, let's go for it. Interesting. Must have been interesting reactions when you wanted to start wrestling.
Yeah, you know, and it took a while to actually be decent at it. You know, the truth is that I went in and, you know, lost a ton of matches early on. And, you know, it's not uncommon for a lot of kids to go and lose matches early on, but, I mean, I lost a lot. Like, I lost every single match my first year and a half, and so I was really on the verge of quitting, giving up. But, you know, and if I had, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now. It's just, you know, it's helped shape my life in a big way. It's a very interesting microcosm for a lot of life experiences, you know, that just that sport in general. You're out there on the mat all alone. You know, it's no different from, you know, the entrepreneur that's got to go and work late nights. You know, it's no different from, you know, the single mom who's got to be able to, you know, work three jobs and go home and cook dinner. You know, it's something where you have to go and make those decisions yourself. And, you know, it's no one else is going to do it for you. That's the thing, you know. In other team sports, then you have the capability of, you know, relying on the team, and the team can go and rely on you and vice versa. But with wrestling, you know, the mental warfare is that you're out there all alone.
Exactly. Now, before the call, something had happened last week. We were supposed to do it, and you weren't able to, and I threatened to kick your butt. I tower over you at 5'1", but then I took those words back because I think you could kick my butt. And so I try to picture, because I don't see any videos on YouTube, but I try to picture some of these moves. How do you pin someone? And if I were wrestling against you, I would do like I think you described in the book, just hold down the top of your head and push you around or something. Try and explain some of these wrestling moves you do, because I'm sure for visual people, we're trying to picture, okay, here's this guy. How's he going to take someone down? How's he going to pin someone? How's he going to get out of a pin? And you had an amazing coach. This coach sounds like godsend to you, because not a lot of wrestlers have your condition, so he must have had to think long and hard of how to do some of the moves. Yeah, so tell us about those, because I'm just trying to visually picture how you can wrestle.
You know, the thing is, I think the strategy was I wanted to just close the contact and the distance. Like you said, a lot of people would go and try to push him ahead and go and stay away, and for me, I would want to come in and attack the legs and try to engage. And it was yeah, that was always the challenge, was just trying to go and try to drive someone, you know, to the point where I could get in and shoot in on their legs. And I would try to work my speed, work my strength advantages over the opponents, and, you know, eventually get in where it was close enough contact where I could kind of do my work. And it's, you know, probably a lot easier for people to visualize once they've seen it. But, you know, if you type my name into YouTube, then there's some jiu-jitsu matches that would pop up different than
wrestling.
But it's yeah, that's kind of the strategy that I have, is the closer I could get to somebody else, and the more I could go and impose my will on them, the further away they would get, then the more challenging it would be to, you know, to bring the fight into my territory.
Exactly. And one of the biggest things I've noticed from your book I love so much is that mental toughness. If that person got in the ring with you and got close enough to you, they were going to know that they were in a match. And that maybe comes from all the adversity you've had to figure out, because, come on, people, try and picture this. Like, no arms and legs. You must have to figure out how to brush your teeth, comb your hair, get dressed, so many things. And so I love that mental toughness that if someone stepped in the ring with you, they better not take pity on you, because it would take about 7 seconds of pity for you to kick them on their butt.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I would, I play it to my advantage if I went out of state to a tournament, you know, and in a different part of the country where people didn't know me or know who I was, then, you know, I'd let them go and throw me around for 30 seconds and let them think that they're going to go and take the match. And, you know, I'd love the look on their face when I grab a hold of them and put them on their back and pin them 10 seconds after that. So it's, those were always some fun moments.
And you even had a little rope-a-dope strategy that I think I only read that you only used it one time, but and didn't actually work that well, did it?
Yeah. That's what was the biggest challenge, was were guys that would just try to stay away. So, you know, I remember, you know, to be pinned in a wrestling match, you have to have both shoulders pressed down for about 2 seconds. And there was a match in the middle of my senior year that, a guy was up on me and by a point decided he was going to go and stay away. So I literally just went to the middle of the mat and lay down on one shoulder and just kind of taunted him in to come in and pin me. So it was...
And he was up ahead a few points, right?
Well, it ended up, yeah, I got an unsportsmanlike conduct called against me. So the referee didn't really understand what was going on, so he just flagged me.
Yeah, but he should have called the stalling on the other guy.
Yeah, you know, the crazy thing is now is, you know, I've talked to wrestlers that are in their, you know, 70s or 80s and yet they can still look back on those matches in high school and, you know, and recount them with the same, memory and visual intensity as it was when they were living it. So those things stay with you for a while.
Exactly. Now, Kyle, one of the things that some people, and my wife included, others, sometimes they would say to me, you're used to being sore, you're used to being disabled. That isn't so true, right? Every day when you can't, like if I drop something on the floor, it frustrates me every day because picking it up is not as easy as bending down to pick it up. I got to go get a reacher, or I got to flip it up in the air on my feet and catch it. You're an amazing guy. You've done some amazing things, but that doesn't mean every day you're like, oh, I'm so glad that I have to go through all these adaptations to do this or that, or if you drop something, maybe probably easier for you to pick stuff off the ground than for me to, because
sure.
You're closer to it. But
we all have that stuff in our lives, and for me, you know, realistically, there, you know, I don't have too many things that are different in a day-to-day. Like right now, as I'm talking to you guys, I'm sitting on a stool cooking lunch, but it's, you know, I would say the other stuff, though, the harder stuff of being, you know, being a motivational speaker and expected to go and motivate other people when we don't always feel motivated ourselves. You know, those are the things that really, you know, that I've struggled with, whereas we all have those down days, you know, and I think it's, for me, and people that pretend to be positive, you know, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, are the ones that kind of freak me out. You know, those are the people that are hiding something kind of serious. Like, I mean, we all have those moments, and it's really those vulnerabilities, I think, that make us into who we are. And without those things, then, you know, we aren't really acknowledging probably our truest sense of self, our truest sense of you know, just, you know, influence in others' lives, too, because that's how we connect with each other is through that vulnerability. It's not through doing everything perfect all the time.
Exactly. One of the biggest challenges people talk to me about, Kyle, is they're finding their, Napoleon Hill calls it the number one success principle, your definite purpose in life. And from reading your book, it looked like, sounded like, you really would have loved to be a wrestling coach the rest of your life. That would have, I think, would have been an exciting job for you. You would have loved it. But then I talk about really, in my case, it has to be a God-given definite purpose, because I had written one that a friend reviewed and said, Tom, that's not your purpose. You're trying to be somebody else who we both knew. And so when I got the one I have, now I feel that, okay, if the Lord was sitting across the table from me, he would say, here's why you're here. And so you've kind of chosen the motivational speaking, or pursued it more than being a wrestling coach, because perhaps that's really why God's allowed you to go through some of the things you have, so that you can really uplift other people.
Yeah, you know, I think I agree with what Napoleon said there 100%. That's really every time that I speak, I talk to people about, you know, in all that you do is to find that why. You know, not what do you want from doing something, or, you know, who do you want to impress, you know, what do you want out of it, you know, why do you want to do it, and really to examine that, you know, that deepest source is comes from that place of understanding why we do what we do. And, you know, for me, I think that there have been different chapters, you know, frankly. It's kind of cool to hear you say that about the book and the wrestling coach, because there would have been a time in my life where I would have looked back and that would have been, you know, a meaningful life. And I think that people that keep it on that path of coaching are, you know, phenomenal and have a huge huge capability of impacting other people. You know, I know now in my life, 7-8 years after removed from the book, you know, then it's like, my life has changed a significant amount, and that probably, you know, wouldn't be the direction that I want to go. You know, to me, the most important thing is to do something just different, something that, you know, similar to a Napoleon Hill. There's a quote that Ralph Waldo Emerson said, you know, he says, you know, do not go where the path may lead, go and, you know, instead to make your own path.
Yeah.
To leave a trail. And that to me is what I think about a lot. You know, it's not to emulate or to, you know, to copy other people that have done the same thing. You know, there's already been a Napoleon Hill. I need to go, you know, a different route. There's already been a Ralph Waldo Emerson. There's already been, you know, a Tony Robbins. You know, to me, it's, you know, I want to go and do something that no one has done before, and to find that why for myself.
Right. And at the same time, you're you really are creating a legacy, because I imagine a lot of people that see you speak will not forget that. And probably as strange as it is for you to hear that and experience that, because you're just in your own mind a guy living a life, that can really leave a legacy for people, where they'll be going back to their life and saying, well, I have it really good after all. And so that is taking an adversity and really, really creating a legacy that can change lives. Now, here's another strange thing I didn't read in the intro. You've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, 19,340 feet, the largest mountain in Africa. That is crazy. So tell me how you got involved with that, because was that part of Free the Children as well, that you went with them on that trip?
No, this was... We actually contracted through a nonprofit called the K2 Adventure Foundation, who I continue to be able to work with now, that actually their mission is domestically here in the U.S. and also internationally in Africa and South America, to work with kids with disabilities and to go and give them the opportunity to, you know, have adaptive equipment and be able to just live a better quality of life and pursue some of the adventures that they want to. And so, yeah, it was, how I ended up doing that. Frankly, I was asking myself that the entire way up the mountain, you know, where I definitely, I loved it, but at the same time, it was one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life, and I had never really been a big hiker. Kilimanjaro was, you know, when we were sitting at the base of the mountain, I had had probably about a dozen total hikes in my life before then, and a lot of them were like less than a mile.
Wow. And you climbed with some amazing, inspiring veterans, right? Chris Hadsell and Sandra, how do you pronounce her last name?
Gambetate, yeah. Chris was a Marine Corps veteran who was an officer in his seventh day in country in Iraq. Then he, after 12 years in the Marine Corps, and the seventh day in his first tour, then he ended up in a suicide car bomb attack. And Sandra, our Army Staff Sergeant, she was in a rider motorcycle on a base and went down and on a motorcycle and told that she would never walk again. So it was, you know, for them, I knew that they were going to be battling their challenges too, and it was fun, you know, just having them there. Chris was kind of this more salty Marine. Sandra was more the supportive one, and is a huge heart. So it was a tremendous amount of fun having them there with me.
Wow. And so what do you take to do that? Do you have a wheelchair some of the time, crawling some, carried some?
It was actually the only time in my life that I've gone for a total of 12 and a half days without a wheelchair. And I wanted to make it to the summit completely unassisted, so it was 100% crawling.
Wow. And there's probably not a lot of trainers who have trained anyone in your condition to climb mountains.
Yeah, you know, it's... The cool thing is I spend a lot of my time, my educational background was, I was a college dropout, so to speak, after 29 hours, and I was studying broadcast journalism, and it really sort of, like, is one of the best things that ever happened to me, because my interest switched and transformed into studying biochemistry and just human performance in general, neuroendocrinology and a number of other things, just to be more self-taught that, you know, about diet and training, and also to psychological factors, to be able to just apply that to my own life and try to reach a higher potential. And it helped a lot. You know, I was able to train hypoxically, meaning I was using a gas mask to train at sea level to go and get used to the altitude. And the further we got, the better I felt, I think, relative to the rest of the group.
Hmm. Wow. What an adventure, my goodness. Now, in reading your book, Kyle, I kind of thought your dad sounds a little bit like MacGyver, MacGyver of the disability world. So after the initial shock, it looks like he just jumped in, and he nothing that you wanted to do was had standard equipment for anything, and it sounds like he just MacGyvered anything you wanted to do to allow you to play the sport and do the things that you did, and even your weightlifting equipment, which lasted you for quite some time with some adaptations, was something your dad put together in his lab, I think, right? So tell me a little bit about some of those great creations, and must create some good father-son bonding as well while you're trying to solve some of these challenges.
Oh, absolutely. His lab was basically the garage with a hacksaw, and he could just go and do whatever he wanted to. You know, he was an electrical engineer by trade, so you know, coming up with different adaptations, whether it was to, you know, figure out how to, you know, cut the trigger guard off of a squirt gun so I could pull the trigger on a squirt gun, or, you know, all the way up to making me a you know, fully adaptive hand crank bike that he made out of a normal trike bike that you go and pedal with your feet that he just took the gearbox and stuff. He's done some really cool stuff for me. And I think the cool thing is probably the most important thing that it's helped impart on me was just that, you know, to start with that presupposition to say that there's always a solution to the problem. You know,
yes.
there's always a way to be able to go and figure it out. It's just a matter of finding out what it is and trying as many different, you know, possibilities, combinations, permutations that you possibly need to get to that point.
I love it. It's so true. And even like I have been a member of a gym for about 14 years, and I can only use about 5 to 10% of the equipment they have there because my joints don't bend or flex very much. But as you said, if you always go in with the idea that this can be solved and there is a contraption that we can come up with, and sounds like your dad kind of enjoyed the challenge a little bit because, as you said, he's come up with some really creative things using a hacksaw and a garage, basically.
Yeah. You know, the truth is, too, is, you know, and this has kind of been my experience now since I opened a gym, is a lot of people come in the gym and don't really have any idea what to do. So even if they are physically capable of using, you know, 90% of the machines or equipment inside of a typical gym, then, you know, really then they don't necessarily know what to do. And, you know, so then people resort to just kind of, you know, going on a treadmill or going on an elliptical and just kind of like riding it out and instead of exploring the full possibilities. What we do with CrossFit is just solely small group training. And it's all about, you know, being jack of all trades, master of none. And you know, each time you go through, you have a coach. You know, if I have a legal issue, then I'm going to go and get a lawyer. If I have an accounting issue, then I'm going to get an accountant. You know, and we outsource these other things in our lives. But yet, for some reason, we try to think that we need to do it all when it comes to, you know, training, nutrition, sleep, other type of maintenance there.
And so that brings me to your another, well, I guess anything that someone with no arms and legs does could be termed improbable until they've met you, but you own a CrossFit gym, and from reading in your book, it sounds like this would be like your place to be. Like you would probably feel so comfortable around people. And all kinds of people go to gyms, whether to get in great shape for as an athlete, whether they're disabled and want to get in better shape. That's how I started after a fourth hip replacement. I started on treadmill to try and get in better shape. And so it sounds like you would be really in your element at this CrossFit gym. So tell me about CrossFit, because I wasn't totally familiar with it when I read about it and I saw the video online, but talk about that and how you came to own a CrossFit gym, because it sounds like that would be really part of what a passion of yours as well.
Yeah, it's definitely been up my alley. The you know, the coolest part the coolest part with the gym is just to see the transformation that people have been able to go and make on it, you know, and just, you know, to your point where, you know, someone may have had, you know, limited range of motion when they started, you know, even without an arthritic diagnosis, and they are, you know, able to do and do so much more down, you know, in just a matter of weeks or months, you know, than they would have thought possible. And to see someone get that functionality in their life back is amazing. That's why most of the people in my gym are, you know, family members, not just the, you know, special forces and the military, but that's another sort of segment that CrossFit has served and catered to. It's because it's, you know, it's an intense training protocol, but the total value of the equipment in my gym is probably less than, like, you know, two or three treadmills at a typical gym. We don't have hardly any equipment. We have barbells, kettlebells, you know, an iron ball with a handle on it, pull-up bars, gymnastics rings. The only machines we have in the place are a rowing machine, and that's, you know, it's about it. It's definitely a minimalist environment in terms of fitness, but at the same time, we have the capability in there to do some pretty incredible things with people, and it's been a fun journey.
Wow, it sounds like it. Kyle, one of the things I had to learn to get better at, when I was young, I was had so much pride. I didn't like asking for help or allowing people to help. One time a kid in high school asked my sister, said, "Well, Tom looks like he has a problem with stairs. I feel like I should help him. Should I offer to help?" And she said, "Please don't do that, because he'll go back up the stairs and come down on his own, just to show you that he can do it." And I kind of love that response, you know, even though you don't always get along with your sister, you think, wow, that's a good one. That really does sum it up. But as I got older, I realized that, A, people love to help other people. And if you deprive them, you're not doing a great thing by depriving them of the ability to help. And second of all, it is a lot easier, life is, if you ask for help when you need it rather than trying to be stubborn and full of pride and taking 19 times as long to do something.
You're absolutely right. You know, and that's something I think that we shared that same determination early on in life, where I would have, you know, done the same thing, you know, and really wanted to do all those things by myself until I realized, you know, that there is a lot easier way to do it. It's, I'll give you for instance, I spend a lot of my time on the road traveling, doing the motivational speaking thing. So, you know, going through the airports a lot, a lot of the time I've got my best friend Joey there with me, who works with me, but I've also to, you know, travel alone a significant amount of the time. So, you know, frequently I used to, you know, turn down the people who would want to go and push my wheelchair, the helpers there at the airport. And,
yeah,
you know, go and tell them I got it, no problem. And I'd pull up to the gate, you know, and I'd be huffing and puffing and sweating. And sometimes, you know, I've torn my arms off a chair wheel and all that. And, you know, then I remember I was going through the Detroit airport, which, if you've flown through Detroit before, it's, you know, just this massively long airport. And I had to go all the way across both sides of this thing. And so this girl, she's actually a pretty attractive girl. She asked me, she was like, you know, "Hey, do you want me to help out, like, push the chair?" And I was, like, thinking in my head, I was like, "Oh, no way. Like, you know, I got this. It's cool." So I was maybe, like, three or four spins of the wheels, and I was
but
like,
the male in you was saying, "Okay, yeah, sure."
Exactly. So it was, you know, like, this is an easier decision than I made it out to be. So it was, you know, at one point, I accepted her help. We went across the gate, had a great conversation, and I showed up to the gate much more comfortable than it would have otherwise been, and it worked out perfect.
And that's how it is so much, and that kind of makes me smile, because when I talk, I tell a few funny stories about, you know, you have to take advantage of your disability when you can. And so at the gym particularly, I can't bend down to reach bars, hook things up. And so, you know, I might have a 280-pound football player walk by me, and I'm not going to ask for help from him. I'm going to wait until the prettiest girl around that area walks by, and I'm going to ask her, "Can you help me hook that up or pick that up or reach that?" And same in the grocery store. I can't reach, obviously, top shelves. And if I need something from one of those top shelves, that same football player could come down the aisle. I'm going to let him pass, and then I'm going to wait for some pretty woman. It's just a little bit of excitement in my day, but it's a lot nicer to ask a pretty woman to help you reach it than some big brute. Have you been able to have some fun with your disability as well?
Oh, absolutely. I have definitely played some pranks in my day. It's, you think you got to be able to laugh in a situation, in a circumstance, you know, it's life's too short. We take ourselves too seriously, I think.
Wasn't there one prank or something that your buddies did something? They put ketchup, tomato paste, or think it was some kind of an elaborate one.
There it was. It was down at it was in Panama City, Florida, at a beach, and I had a buddy dressed as a lifeguard, and another one pulled me out of the water and dumped an entire can of a big can of tomato puree sauce on my arms and legs, and everyone started screaming. You know, I was shaking on the ground. Everyone started yelling shark attack. And so we had a whole group of people that pulled up there, and like, and probably 50, 60 people, like, you know, looking around, and like, this girl's like started crying, so she called 911. So I popped up and said, "I'll see you guys later."
Yeah, cancel that 911 call. I'm fine.
Exactly.
I laughed when I read that one in your book. It's like, wow, you went to some good lengths there to figure out a great prank. And so it helps, and I think it helps people deal with someone like yourself when if you can laugh and make fun of yourself, then they know, okay, this isn't a big factor for him.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, some of the coolest people I've ever met in my life have the, you know, strangest sense of self-deprecating humor. I think that's got to be it's going to be one of Napoleon Hill's success laws in there somewhere. I don't know.
I think so. Now, one thing that used to annoy me doesn't annoy me anymore. Kids, you know, sometimes in wherever I'm walking, sometimes you'll hear kids whisper. You know how kids whisper? You could hear it like two hallways over. "Mom, why is that guy so short?" And yeah, you must get kids asking their parents similar things. And in the past, I used to think of vengeful scenarios of kicking their ass or scolding them. But now I'm like, okay, this is just a kid. He doesn't understand. And so you must get that as well. And you must get horrified parents that are like, "Shh, be quiet."
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, I feel more sorry for the parents than I do for the kids. You know, the kids, like you said, are curious, and they don't know any different, you know, but it's the parents then that give someone that fear that they can't, like, be open and talk to someone else, you know. They tell a kid to, like, you know, shh, be quiet, and it's like, to me, you know, there's a lot better way to handle the situation. Not everybody wants, you know, is at the same place, you know, with acceptance that you or I are, that would be open to talking to someone, you know, but at the same time, you know, you don't have to, you know, to shush somebody or, you know, or implant that fear in the kid. You know, it's just really, there was a really sad event one time that I saw where it was a man, his kid was like, you know, kind of like pointing at me and saying, "Look, Dad, look, Dad." And the kid, you know, wouldn't stop, and I smiled at him and stuff, but, like, the dad, like, was trying to get his son to stop and was, like, trying to stand in his way, and finally, like, took his kid and shoved him against a door and, like, just, you know, was almost abusive with it, and it was, like, such a sad thing, because, I mean, now that kid can have that, you know, that neurological association with, you know, with experiential association with disability, you know, for the rest of his life, potentially, and
exactly,
that's not a cool thing.
No, and you've been studying. You're using some three-syllable, four-syllable psychology terms there. Very good, very good.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Oh, very good. Oh, you looked them up before the interview and determined
right
to use them. Now, Kyle, one thing that's so beneficial to me is obviously my parents, like your case, but also I have two sisters, younger sisters, and, you know, we fought, and I pulled her hair, I spit in one's hair in the middle of a hallway in school, and so we had those disagreements, but, you know, the one a year younger than me was the one who said, "Don't help him, you know, he's so prideful that he'll do it himself," and so she never let me slide with anything. And my other sister, she would sit at the end of the couch when I would have an arthritis attack. I literally couldn't move head to toe, and she would sit there waiting for me to ask to go get a juice or change the channel, which is telling you how old I am, where you had to change the channel and get up to do that. And so what a tremendous blessing. I even had at one time two newspaper routes, and that's probably the dumbest thing in a really cold city in Canada to have newspaper routes. And when it would be, when I'd be too sore, I'd have my sisters do them, and I would pay them less than I actually earned if I'd done it myself. So still made money on the days they did it. And I think I probably faked a few when it's like minus, you know, a gazillion degrees in Canada. And I probably, you know, faked a little bit to have them do it. But that's the type of sisters they were. They didn't cut me any slack. They didn't, like, you know, okay, you know, Tom has to do the cut the lawn just like we do, or Tom has to do this. And so, and yet at the same time, if I needed help, I just had to ask, really. And so it sounds like you have amazing sisters like that, too.
Oh, I do. They're unbelievable girls. And, you know, kind of the same thing with you. I've, you know, come up with games to, you know, have them. I had three younger sisters, so, you know, they were all around the same age growing up. And it was the two younger ones, especially when I was old enough to understand how to, well, be a little bit more manipulative to get what I wanted, and I would go and have them, you know, like, race to go and try to, like, you know, give me a bowl of ice cream or something like that. So they would, you know, they'd do the whole countdown thing. And we've got a really special mom, though, now. And now my sister, Amber, who's closest to me in age, she just had her first baby. So first baby niece, and that's a pretty special thing. She's definitely stolen my heart.
Wow. Kyle, one thing I just realized lately myself, when I look back, probably realized it, but just really didn't want to think of it, but I'm helping a 16-year-old girl who has some self-image problems. She's actually beautiful, thinks she isn't. When I was young, I had the problem that I would thought, as far as women, that they deserve better, they should be with someone better, missed a bunch of opportunities that now that I know they were interested, and I just let it go. And it doesn't sound like that's a problem for you. When you have good self-esteem, you know that you can bring value to a relationship. And yet at the same time, you got to understand, I imagine women, you know, they got to tell their friends, well, I'm dating Kyle and he's unique. And they'll be like, oh, wow, unique is good. Well, really unique. And so has that been a challenge, or have you had to adjust your thinking or had to deal with things other people don't have to deal with there?
Yeah, I think I mean, the whole self-esteem thing, too, is kind of a, you know, kind of a weird word. To me, it's like I wonder what, you know, what does self-esteem even really mean? And I think a lot of it has to do with, comes down to, you know, how you perceive yourself in the eyes of others. And I think that that's only remedied by trying to change the way that we perceive ourselves, period, in our own eyes. And the, you know, I think regarding women, when I was in high school, you know, it was a train wreck talking to girls. I was scared out of my mind and, you know, really struggled with it a lot. And it wasn't until, you know, I was older that I was able to, you know, just to, like you said, you know, to accept the fact, you know, more accept myself and you know, and less look for validation from someone else, that, you know, then I could realize that, you know, this person might augment, you know, my life in some way, but they were not going to make my life. And, you know, I was the only one that could go in and to make my life. But, and it's, you know, that's not to say, too, that even after that realization that things are, you know, that, like, you know, 100% perfect and work out. And I've been in, you know, some great relationships before with some great girls that, like, you know, random stuff would go and come up, and I would learn that, you know, they had some major doubt or insecurity in terms of, you know, what happens if my, you know, car breaks down, or what happens if my bracelet breaks, you know, would you be able to go and fix this? And, you know, the strange thing is, the thought that goes through my head is, you know, even if I had arms and legs, I probably wouldn't know how to fix your car, because that's just not my interest, you know? So, you know,
my thought would be, hey, I make enough money that I can get the best guy in the city to fix those for you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's, you know, it's just there are different ways to go and take care of people. But it's interesting how, you know, not to pass judgment on it or whatever else, but, you know, how a lot of, you know, people, other significant others would, you know, would perceive those things. I actually read a blog post last night from a girl who was a single arm amputee, and she said, that her husband, not husband, I'm sorry, she's younger, she said it was her boyfriend. Her boyfriend asked her, he had torn his pants or something like that, and asked her if, if she knew how to sew. And she had never learned how to sew, but told him that she knew how to do it anyway, and then had to go and, kind of figure it out. Realized that, she was probably never going to go and make a dress for Versace, but once she really sat down to, figure it out, then she could. And, but it's really, there are those moments that they think that, anyone with a disability, a physical disability, or, an internal disability that we can't see, or the significant other of that individual, those are some of the things that have to be addressed and talked about. It doesn't do any good just to have that, attitude of avoidance and keeping it in. I think being open and communicating it is critically important.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, at some point you probably have had some conversations like, you may have noticed I'm disabled. And, then it would start from there. You have to talk about it, and you can't ignore it. Like, someone's going to be like, describing you to their girlfriends and like, well, he's short. He has short hair. No, you have to talk about it. And
right.
if you are comfortable about it yourself and with who you are. But I had made a note earlier also as well that when I really became comfortable is when I came to understand in God's eyes, we're all the same, loves us all the same. And then when I saw that, it's like, okay, we're all here for a purpose. We're all loved equally by God. Not, the tall people are not loved more by God than the short people. And from there, then I was like, okay, well, if that's where it starts, God loving me, then anybody else, well, you can or you can't, but I don't care.
Yeah, and that's where I think it's an individual realization that we have to come to on our own terms, because you can't go in and tell someone, you take a kid that's going through high school right now that's, depressed or being bullied, you can't tell them, to go up and, suck it up or go and accept yourself or, it's no big deal. It's a really big deal to them.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really hard time. And that individual's got to go and come to find acceptance and whatever that means to them on their own terms. And it's really something that has to be experienced, I think. And it's really, I my opinion, I think it's a lifelong journey. I don't think we ever get to that point where we've arrived. Frequently, I will go and look at other writers or other, authors, other speakers, and I will go and compare myself to them and go and say, oh man, I don't know if I'll ever be able to go and do that as a speaker,
All right.
Go on a forum with a 100,000 people like a Deepak Chopra, or I don't know if I'll ever be able to do, this as a writer like, Theodore Roosevelt was able to do. But we put ourselves up to these unreachable standards, and we really victimize ourselves by this attitude of comparison that's kind of unnecessary.
Exactly. Comparison is not great, and we tend to compare ourselves against the greatest and the best and the tallest. And in fact, 40% of the world lives on less than $2 a day. And you and I are no nicer than them to be born in North America than to be born in a third world country. So if you're going to compare to how you are globally instead of how you are to your, 7-foot neighbor or wealthy neighbor or whatever, and you see that you have been blessed already, where you may not have seen it before. Kyle, thanks so much for your time today. I could speak to you for hours, but your lunch is getting cold there. I love the choice you made to do the motivational speaking. You could be a wrestling coach. You would have loved that. It would have impacted lives, but I believe that God's purpose for you is to just go around, be an ordinary guy where people can say, wow, look at what he did. I can do this too. And probably surprises you that, at times where you're really like, wow, I can't believe I do this for a living. This is just me. But keep up the great work. It really will impact hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people.
Thanks, Tom. Thank to you too, you know, to continue encouraging people, you know, the way that you are. I think there's, you know, really, I think it comes down to, you know, two types of people on the planet. Either we're striving to go and make this world a little bit better place, or we aren't. And it's just to continue to know that, you know, we got to stay in that good fight to, you know, to improve the things that we can.
Exactly. God bless, Kyle. Have an amazing day, and thank you so much. I'll be walking about a foot taller for 3 days now after this conversation.
Thanks, man. Great to talk to you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.